Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer Richard Chickie, who will discuss working on the latest Dream Theater album. But first of all, let's talk about AM radio, because it's dying. Yes, it is. For the longest time now, it's been low man on the totem pole when it comes to the Arbitron ratings. And for the most part, you don't hear much music on AM anymore because it's now the bastion of sports and talk radio. And it's always on the bottom. It's always getting the worst ratings. As a result, there's not as much money being put in AM radio. And in some places, it is actually dying out. So for instance, what's happening is in Norway and Germany, guess what? AM radio has been discontinued. The famous Radio Luxembourg, no more AM radio. Armed Forces Radio, which was a standard in Europe forever, no more in AM. And instead, most countries in Europe are getting rid of AM and they're going to digital audio broadcasting instead, DAB. What we're going to see in the United States is something similar, not completely as all-encompassing, but something similar pretty soon. One of the reasons why is electric cars don't have AM radios. You know why? There's too much electrical noise. In order to get rid of it, what would have to happen is you'd have to have an old-fashioned antenna outside the car. And guess what? Nobody wants that. So we're going to see fewer and fewer AM radios in cars, and if that happens, that's going to be the death knell. However, I kind of think that AM radio, I've been hoping this would happen for years, and maybe it finally will happen. As soon as AM radio kind of drops off the radar and drops off the corporate radar, especially when it comes to big station groups that kind of own all of radio now, I'm hoping that we'll find local owners come back into radio. Buy the small radio stations, even the large radio stations, and keep the programming local, just the way it used to be in the 50s and 60s and 70s and even into the 80s. What happened then is radio was very local in that it served everything in the locality. And that includes music as well. So it was a reflection of the musical tastes of the particular area. And as soon as the radio station groups came in and brought in consultants, what we found out was you heard pretty much the same playlist across the country. So we had the homogenization of radio, especially AM radio. And as a result, there was a whole lot less interesting local things going on. If they were happening, we weren't aware of them because local radio just wasn't there and it wasn't serving the locality and it wasn't playing anything. So in a way, I'm kind of hoping that the death of AM radio will actually be its rebirth as well. So we'll see what happens there. Another thing I want to talk about is the fact that the RIAA this last week finally made it official. 1,500 streams equal one album. So in other words, if you have 1,500 streams off of an album, that means it's the equivalent of one album sale. Why this is significant is for assigning gold and platinum records, they have to come up with some sort of metric. And the 1,500 track streams equal one album sale is that metric. And actually, consultants have been using this for a while, so this isn't new. It's just the fact that the RIAA has finally adopted it. The thing that's unfair about this is it could mean one particular song gets 1,500 streams, and then it's the equivalent of one album sale, even though there's only one song that people are hearing. So it's not really the same thing as buying an album and going through it. Even if you heard the song only once, or even partially once, you at least were exposed to it. And now that's not the case at all. So it's somewhat unfair. But I can't think of another way to do that. If anybody else can, let me know, because even the RIAA can't figure this out. So at least that's one place that there is some metric. And again, whether it's a good metric or bad, I'm not quite sure, but it's all we have right now. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 mixing tricks, big studio tricks with a small studio. Now it's available by the module. So go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Last week, we talked about Guitar Center and what was happening there. This week, it's Avid who's in the news. There was a bunch of layoffs at Avid, mostly in the audio side, not in the picture, in the audio side. So what happened is a lot of the R&D and the beta and QA and customer service people got whacked. The rumor is, and from these layoffs, it seems to be the case, that Avid is now placing more emphasis on the picture side than the audio side. So this is not a good development. What it shows is that Avid, like most public companies, are more concerned about the stockholders than its customers. This is always something that's problematic, and it's especially problematic in a small industry like the audio business. Avid had to do something because their stock is in the toilet. It's hovering around the $6.50 per share area as I record this. But that being said, it was once at a high of almost $70. Now you can see how if you're a stockholder, an Avid stockholder, you're not very happy at the situation at all. So as a result, they're doing everything they can to raise that stock price, and none of it bodes well for the Pro Tools user. There's a lot of us that are out there waiting for something to happen. We're either waiting for the next digital audio workstation to come down the pike, and there's lots of rumors, but there's nothing yet. Or we're waiting for Avid to go under, or just decide to jettison the Pro Tools part of Avid, the audio side of Avid, and hopefully some other company will buy it and turn it into a better product and a product that we can all use again. Right now, all you Pro Tools users out there, and I'm one of them, we're all on pins and needles waiting to see what will happen and see if we're going to have updates this year, if they're going to be worthwhile for the $99 a year or the $199 a year that we have to pay. Let's see what happens and keep your fingers crossed. My guest today is engineer Richard Chickie, who just completed the new Dream Theater album, which turned out to be a massive technical undertaking. Richard will give us some inside details that will probably blow your mind in some sort of way. We spoke live from Oasis Mastering in Burbank, California. Before we start, I wanted to tell you that I learned something from you on the last interview that we did that I use all the time. And it was one of those things where I hit myself in the head and think, why didn't I know this before?
What's that?
Recording distorted guitars direct for editing.
Yes.
Later.
Oh, the clean, putting the clean.
Yeah, yeah.
You never thought of that, really?
No, I never thought of that. And as soon as I used it, it was like, this is so brilliant. I can't believe it. It was just so easy afterwards.
Yeah, the only thing you have to do is just watch the, when you look at clean guitar, it looks like there's a transient.
Yeah.
But for distorted guitar, there's always that little bit of next to nothing on the clean channel. You have to anticipate it because that little bit of clean at the beginning is the... Yeah. Of the guitar. That's about it. Oh, yeah. I can't believe. I feel bad. I can't imagine what some of the editing was.
It was crazy. Yes.
Wow.
It
was really great.
Was not easy, but it's pretty good. So tell me about the new Dream Theater album. You spent a lot of time on it.
The new Dream Theater album is The Astonishing. It's a double CD, right? It's 2 hours plus. Mm-hmm. It's a total of 34 songs. 34 songs, a really bold undertaking for a band that just celebrated their, I think it's their 30th anniversary. It's a really bold undertaking. I know when we were finishing up the last album, John had mentioned that he had a few ideas what he wanted to do for the next record. And literally this record was the initial writing of the concept. It's a full-fledged concept record, really in a style of rock opera. John took the time to write the entire story, and he sent me the layout of the story. Like, this would be last summer. He had sent me a layout of the outline of what the story was going to be, and it crosses between two different lines, almost retro-y, old, it feels kind of Game of Thrones retro to sci-fi, so the story is really complex, and, we had a long discussion of everything was going to be organic, So, Jordan is really into the synthesis world. This is real strings, real brass, three different types of choir. We recorded Jordan with Steinway, B3. So there's actually, from a synthesis point of view, there's very, very little synthesis. I think we used his Roly Seaboard synth And we used Geo Shred and then a couple of, you know, synth pads, but really, really high percentages, all organic. So it's such a bold undertaking. You know, they really wanted to be the red shirt in a room of white shirts.
Wow. Just curious, so often strings are used as pads.
Yes.
And it really helps if you have those pads on early in the process of recording, but mm-hmm. usually strings are recorded later in the process. How did it work in this case?
In this case, you and I chatted while I was in Los Angeles last year, mm-hmm. And I flew straight across from Los Angeles on January 29th to New York, and I was under the impression that we were going to begin recording the record, and what we ended up doing is the outlines were actually being formed then. So I was using Logic and we were recording all the outlines. And Jordan, both Jordan and John are really great at arranging. So we had all of the elements were laid out, all of the arrangements for strings, everything was laid out in synthesizers or samplers. Mm-hmm. So we had all of the arrangements, just like you're saying, we had them at the very beginning. It's just that they were synthetic.
Yeah.
So we were working with them at the very, very beginning, and the arrangements were handed off to David Campbell, and David Campbell fine-tuned the work. And then as we were working, we started to get the real elements, and literally we would just substitute in the real strings, right? In the real strings and just turn off the synthetic elements. So the quality changed, right? And the emotion in the performance obviously changed because we have a room full of people playing. But the idea from the instruments and the arrangement, that remained really consistent. So it wasn't really jolting, aside from, you know, making us all smile with the huge jump up in quality. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, oh my God, we've got a huge issue with this guitar part doesn't really work with the strings. We already had everything in place well before we started recording the rest of the band.
Was there an issue, though, where you replaced something and then went, oh, that really affects what we did over here, and now we have to re-record that?
All the time. Well, not really re-record it with... that would be something that there would be the initial demo of material. Well, the initial demo of material, there are some pieces, say, of guitar that we kept made from the demo all the way to the finished project, because we were using John's full-blown guitar rig we set up at the very beginning. Because like I had mentioned, when I flew over, my initial impression was that we were going to start recording the album. And when I record a larger album, I have a tendency to set up stations where I have all the drums set up, all the bass, all the guitars, vocals. Because on any given day, you know, we could come in and say, you know, I was working on this, vocal, so let's try and see how it works. So instead of us doing, say, guitar solos that day, we might jump over to a vocal or an acoustic guitar or anything. So I kind of have everything set up all the time. So John's guitar rig was set up for recording, and even though we're doing layouts at that time, we were all set to do the album. So it's still recorded album quality. So, you know, and if there was something he was really happy with, he would make it to the finish line. And if not, we could just say, you know, now this piece here, now that the strings are doing this, we need to modify this slightly so it does this.
Yeah.
So that did come up, but it didn't involve really going backwards and having to, it really was just a simple matter of like punching in, you know?
Well, that being said, you must have stayed basically in the same studio most of the time in order to do that.
We were in Cove City Studios on Long Island from January 29th. Except for doing vocals, we were there all the way up till, I'm trying to think, it was September, later in September, I think, is when we wrapped up. So it was long, long, long time, except we took a break while the band went and did a tour run overseas.
Yeah, yeah.
And
did you keep everything set up while they were?
Well, while they were away, no, we didn't. As soon as we had wrapped up drums, prior to their touring. So obviously our setup condensed down quite a bit. We didn't have all of the main rhythm elements set up, but we did have guitars set up, and we did have anything to do with keyboards set up.
Yeah. Did you record at 96K?
All at 96K. The largest song we had topped out, including all the elements, all the orchestral elements and overdubs, the top, the, the biggest song was 577 tracks at 96K.
That's mind-boggling.
It's mind-boggling for musicians. Right? It's funny because I talk to anybody that's involved in making records, they go, oh, 577 tracks. Anybody that's involved in movies, they go, ha, rookie.
Yeah, right.
Rookie, that's small.
Yeah. No, I have a buddy that regularly does 2,000 tracks.
It's insane. It's insane. Yeah. So it's really funny. All movie guys are going, so I guess you're ready to come over to the dark side and start working on movies there, brother. You know.
Did you do it all in one machine?
Pro Tools? Mixing? David Campbell, when he was sending back material, you know, when we did, when he sent back choir, you know, I should clarify by saying when I say it's 577 tracks, I don't mean it's 577 different elements.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So, you know, there's quite a few mics involved to recording orchestra or choir. And David's been doing this a long time. So any of the recording was done to... with microphones in place for contingencies, you know, if we have a hotspot and we have a hotspot, or we need to pull somebody up in the orchestra, there's extra spot miking done. So, we ended up using during the mix phase. I was using 3 Pro Tools rigs. I brought mine down, and then there was the studios, and then the band had one. So we had 3 rigs all locked together with word clock and time code, and we would do sub mixes in all the 3 rigs, and then those 3 rigs were feeding an SSL Duality. We mixed it over at Troy Germano's place, Germano Studios in New York.
Was there any problems syncing 3 machines up?
You know what? No. They actually, you know, at the initial idea of just working out word clock and make sure everybody's playing nice with each other, once all that was put together, you know, more cable runs and making sure, you know, word clock, everything has to be really great quality. You know, if you have any bad cables, it's woefully apparent with word clock. So it literally was getting the word clock set up and then just getting time code, you know, getting time code to everything. So everybody knew all the machines knew where they were at, and the lockup was fine. You know, it's so fast, you know, it's not mechanical, it's not tape. It's so fast that it's really not noticeable.
Yeah. Yeah. Was there any picture involved?
Picture as in video? There was no video involved for the album. You know, aside from things that the band is doing now for the promotional part, but no, there's no video involved at all.
So there's nothing shot during the process?
Like a making of sort of thing?
Yeah.
There's some available. And the funny thing is that the pace that we worked at, it's such a large undertaking that the pace that we worked at was, you know, there were no video crews around, and it literally was, so, you know, really pounding the pavement to get the record done, because it's such a huge 2 complete records. So to do the both in is roughly 10.5 months, including writing. You know, look at that. You go, you know, that's kind of like a little over 5 months a record from nothing.
Yeah.
No, not even nothing recorded. No demos recorded. Nothing to being completely finished. That's really a feverish pace. So while it felt long, it was actually very short from the amount of content that was done.
How about basics? It sounds like the way you did it, there was no basic tracking per se. It sort of happened when it happened, and maybe even some of the demos or the writing turned into the songs themselves.
The demos, most of the rhythm guitars were recut. Rhythm guitars were recut for the most part. We did keep some solos that John had done because he's just one of those players that even when he has an idea off the cuff, you know, I mean, he's an amazing technician, and he's got great technique, and his ideas are really musical. And, you know, when we were listening to this, there's some stuff we just went, I mean, this sounds so good like this. Why change it?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the changes did come in with Jordan had structural ideas as far as bass. So that changed a lot because, you know, once bass and drums existed over the frame of what they had written, that's really where the most change would happen. You know, the rhythm guitars would have to lock up, and everybody would have to lock up to all the new elements that were being recorded.
Do you have any special miking techniques for Dream Theater that you may do differently from someone else?
You know, it's recording them is really, it's like recording any other band, just more, because it's intricate. It's a large setup, but still sort of the foundation of the technical approach of recording is the same as any other band, is to watch phase, be careful of phase, use the right microphone for the right job, and, you know, just keep an eye on things, don't overload things unless you want to overload them. And it's the basic thing. You know, I have a tendency to be pretty careful with phase. Mangini's kit has quite a few mics around it, so phase becomes important. You know, the selection of core microphones. I use a lot of ribbon microphones around his drum kit, so everything is phase aligned to the snare drum. And his kit is set up a little bit differently. He's got like a V shape for toms. His toms, rather than having like the snare sits dead center of the kit, rather than slightly off to the side. So in that way, it's really fantastic. It's a really stable way to record. You get a really strong drum image. And, you know, with John, with guitar, I use a Royer, like a 121. I use a Royer 121 and a Mojave MA-301 FET, right? And those are those two microphones comprise like the core of his guitar sound. And we used during this we were using a Mesa Boogie. It was a prototype of, there's a signature amp that just came out. And we used a JP2C, which is the official name of this amp. We used that for the whole record. So, you know, we were dealing with a guitar sound that was slightly different from, you know, all of the original. He's got a bunch of 2C pluses and Mark 5s and 4s and 3s and tri-axis. So this time we had all that stuff there, but we literally used the one amp for the entire record. So that was a big change, but it was great because it was such a versatile amp.
Wow, it must be.
You know, it's amazing. It really is. It's like there's a promo out right now that Ernie Ball has for one of John's signature guitars. And in that picture is an old 2C Plus, right? And that is the 2C Plus that was the gauge for his signature amp, and it's in the pictures, and you know, that's not the amp that we were using to record, but that's the one that was modeled that they'd use for a template. And it really is, it's one of those magic amps, you know, it's aged just right, tubes sound just right, and it's really, really killer. You just click it on, it's like, yeah, that's it. And so this is the JP2C is a really, really great 2C Plus. It's like finding one of those, but it's not, you know, you try three or four of them and they all have that great sound. It's not just that one special one that you have to age right for 25 or 30 years.
Yeah. You know. Let's come back to recording drums. Mm-hmm. You mentioned phase is important to you. Yeah. How are you aligning phase? Are you doing it with a plug-in, a device? Are you doing it by ear?
I use this really old-fashioned way called a tape measure. I literally tape measure and make sure that for the overheads that we've got good distance, equal distance for the from the snare. And I mean, things like tom mics, you know, they're not open all the time. The tom mics flip open for a second, you know, as the tom is struck, and then decay. You know, the level is decayed down with the toms, so that you know, we don't have a whole lot. He has a lot of metal and stuff ringing on the kit, so to keep it under wraps, you know, I have my assistant go in and draw in some automation, so that the toms are, they're not gated, but just the level is under control and it's very definitive. So there's no gate chatter.
Yeah,
you know, they open when Mangini actually strikes the drums. You know, so it really is. It's just a function of getting, so you could turn up the overhead mics and you've got a really good image with the snare and kicks dead center, you know, and then it's literally, it just goes adding. I used a Royer 24V, which is a stereo tube ribbon mic,
yeah,
and then a 122V in mono directly underneath it. So it's kind of like a set of blum line, and then there's an extra set of nodes in front and in rear because of the mono 122V.
Yeah.
So that blend allows you to get a really good like mono image, but it's very wide because of the blum line. And you can adjust that. So that was, and everything is ribbon, so it's not like really, really hard sounding. You know, the mics just sound so good for complex, for drums, and you can get everything nice and breathing without sounding brittle.
So your overheads are for the whole kit, and you're getting the whole sound rather than just the cymbals.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. Kind of have to, because the kit is, his kit is physically very wide. It's a large kit, and it's one of those things, they have to kind of play with it to get it so that there's not a hole in the center of the kit, you know? Mm-hmm. And having it phase accurate really... Having so it's accurate phase wise really helps with that.
How about the bass? What are you doing with the bass?
With bass, we were recording bass direct, and then we used a we used a Suncoast and a Mesa. The Suncoast is a company that has come up with a piece that is like the old. Do you remember there was a bass amp called a Pierce?
Oh yes, sure.
Pierce. That's right. Billy Sheehan. It was made popular by Billy Sheehan,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this guy has put the preamp of that into a pedal called a Suncoast. Hmm. So we ended up using a DI, a Suncoast, and then a Mesa, and it's just literally blending the three together.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, jeez. Really, really good. Really good. The Suncoast was a new surprise. The Maddie Schieferstein, who is John Petrucci's guitar wizard, he's the guy that he got this thing brought in, saying, "Yeah, a buddy of mine's got this thing, and, you know, it's one of those pedals you plug in, and it just sounded so right."
Yeah, yeah.
That you just go, I think we're just going to keep using this for a bit, you know. And my young came in; he did a great job. You know, they all come in and do their things. It's really great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's jump to mixing for a second. So you have a huge number of tracks. I assume you're submixing in the box, and then you have stems coming out, right?
Yes. For, for looking at drums, for Mangini's, he's got a total of 12 toms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Got 12 toms, and he's got eight, and then he's got four up top that he uses. And... those are submixed to save space, and if there's any fine tuning, we do that within Pro Tools. That comes back on a couple channels on the console,
mm-hmm.
and of course, because of all the automation that's in Pro Tools, they come out really clean, and you don't have to run gating on the console or anything like you used to have to do. So that becomes unnecessary. It literally is taking stems, things like, obviously guitars were not stemmed, that they didn't have to be stemmed with. Strings were, the submixes were done on the individual rigs, right? Mm-hmm. On the separate Pro Tools rig, and then that fed the console. And we would commit the submixes because we had to go through and do some cleanup, and because there's a lot of people in the room, right? So there's things like we had an orchestra, we had a choir take done, and at the very end of the choir take, when the room is still decaying, it literally sounded like somebody had like unvelcroed a shoe. And we said, "Oh, I'll just fade it down." You could hear the fade. The fade sounded odd because it was cutting out the room decay. And we were trying forever to get rid of this thing with all sorts of noise reduction software. And finally we were successful. But this is, this is all kind of all the little surprises that you get.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was, everything was submixed, feeding the SSL. And I think in the total of, in 34 songs, I think there was maybe eight or nine times where we had to revisit and say, we want to hear, one element a little bit more, went back and just reprinted the stem with the adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really a huge deal, it's just a bit of a process, but it works out fine.
Were most of your effects in the box or were they external?
No, I actually brought my, for this record, I brought a lot of my, my equipment with me from my studio. There's a lot of effects that are hardware.
Yeah,
a lot of hardware going on, right?
Well, like what?
Well, a lot of stuff, a bunch of Lexicon stuff, PCM 96S, 300L, a Bricasti M7, a lot of stuff like that. I mean, not to say that we didn't use any effects that are in the box. I mean, I also used a Fractal for John. I used a Fractal for John for some of the delay and some of the modulating effects on his guitars, so... But a lot of it is, a lot of the core, like reverbs and spaces are Bricasti and my Lexicons, And which, you know, and plugins are absolutely fine, but we did plugins. We did a lot of plugin stuff on the last record, and we were trying to get a little bit of a different texture for this record.
Can you hear the difference?
You know, the funny thing is yes. Yeah, you do. I did hear a difference, you know, and it's one of those things where they sit in the mix really well, you know, and it's one of those things that in a sparse mix, it becomes less of an issue, but when something's really complex, you do hear it. And yeah, it's just one of those things that you can have more elements coexist, you know, in the same sound field, and you can hear all of them as opposed to them getting jumbled together.
Yeah.
And I wish I knew what it was, because, you know, I would bottle it and I would sell it to everybody.
No kidding.
But I don't know what it is, but there is something there. And, you know, is it psychoacoustic? I don't know, but I don't know. But it's one of those things that it felt right, so we go with it instead of trying to fight it and say, well, you know, we have to do this in the box. We have to do this with hardware. There were no rules. We just did, you know, we were just working with... we just brought all the resources that we had, everything at our disposal. Oh, yeah, and I used a couple of Eventides I have in my rack, so I used those as well. So, and then we also used a bunch of different plugins at the same time. So it was busy.
Did you find that the mix went faster or slower because you were on a console rather than in the box?
Well, mixing on the, I think for, in the grand scheme of things, the, you know, being completely in the box, if there is absolutely no hardware, one of the things that is a great benefit is the idea that you can stem out more at the same time. And what we ended up having to do is, you know, when we were printing some stems, that, you know, I would leave my assistant to do multiple passes of stems, and that takes time. Mm-hmm. So that piece in itself takes time. But the record was just from the sheer size of it, the record was worked out to be 700 hours of mixing in 51 days. So it's like a huge, really, really long days.
Wow, I'll
say. Yeah.
I bet it took you a while to recover, huh?
I'm still working on that.
So what was a typical song then? How long would it take?
To mix?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? The first few songs took longer because, you know, you want to find the ultimate method, and we're still, you know, getting vocal sound set up and getting guitars routed, and, you know, what am I going to do with this? What am I going to do with that? So getting placements done. And then after a while, you know, you start to see the positioning and the numbers on the console start to get more sort of hammered into place. And it gets faster.
Yeah. Because I remember that the standard used to be a day and a half.
I mean, we had a few songs that were more, it's funny because some of the songs that were really, really huge and complex, you figure, oh, it's going to take forever. And all of a sudden, boom, you know, the song's done in less time than a much simpler song, you know, where there's a lot of space, and you go, but I want to get, the whole idea is it feels done when you have, you know, the vibe feels correct. And this record is in particular very story oriented. So the energy level of each song has to match where it is in the story.
Okay.
So it wasn't just a matter of mixing. We actually started by mixing a few core tracks, and then after that it was like, we need to start at the beginning and then mix so that the mixes match where they are in the story. And sometime we'd be a few hours in, and John say, you know, I'm kind of thinking we should be going this way, and we would just stop and go back and change directions, and that would take a bit of time.
It's a matter of changing the intensity or the energy then, right?
100%. That's exactly what it is, where there's songs that are heavy and dark, and the story is, you know, there's a song called Moment of Betrayal, where there's this realization that one character has to betray another, and it's heavy. It's a heavy thing from a thematic point of view. And then, okay, we need to get it so that the music is matching what's going on. And there's also a lot of sound effects of some characters. There's some because there's two different factions that are kind of battling in this in the story, that there's, you know, there are some military sounding aspects, and then there's aspects of the other characters that are coming basically to quote unquote save the day, save the world, and music has to match all that.
Did you find yourself muting any elements, considering that I could imagine the arrangements were quite large? And many times what happens is when you hear an arrangement in your head, and when you finally hear it, and especially trying to fit it into a story, it may be that you'd say, well, this is over a range, I got to pull some things out. Uh-huh. Did that happen at all?
That's a really good question. The short answer is yes. And what we ended up doing is I had mentioned David Campbell would record with a common recording is to have a Decca tree put overhead, and that existed for strings, for orchestra, for brass, for choir. That existed everywhere. We had Decca and then spots. Now, in particular, say in the choir, there is in the classic choir that was recorded, there was a soprano. There was one woman that was just iron lung. It was unbelievable how loud she was. A great tone, but she was just, she would sing up, and you can hear her in the very first song that was released, Gift of Music. You can hear her in the upper register, and she's just tearing it up. But in the Decca, it was so overbearing that we actually had to start to resort to a lot of the spot mics to even out the choir.
Wow.
You know? So, yes, we ended up, the balances had to be changed, and we were cutting out, you know, we started to pull down the elements that as we got closer and closer to her because she was just so loud, you know, and she was just loud in the room. And, you know, each section of the choir, it wasn't recorded discreetly. It was recorded as a group.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yes, we had to go through and fine-tune elements, you know, and sometimes that involved turning other stuff off, you know, to get us even.
What was the most fun for you in this project?
The most fun, I mean, it was a lot of work. The most fun was that as it gets put together more and more, you could see that it's going to work. And really the fun of it is just watching all of this stuff come together, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's such a huge undertaking that it kind of fights, and this might be a bit stereotypical, but it fights the current trend of, you know, we need to do things. So, you know, we're going to record this at our house, and we're going to make stuff small. They went the other way. We're going to do this big. We want to do something really big and epic, not in the formal sense of the word.
Yeah.
Really, really a large undertaking, a big story, and something that's different. It's progressive rock, and this band is doing something that is, it's progressive. It's different than what done before. Mm-hmm. And I can't speak highly enough about a band that's going to take such huge undertaking and take it onto themselves at this stage in their career. And it was actually fun because, you know, when you drop in stuff and you would see that it worked and what it did to the story, and, you know, anything from these synthetic, there are these vignettes of audio of these synthetic Nomac units that would play their own version of music, which is very dissonant, but as far as they were concerned, that is the correct type of music for society. And, you know, Jordan would come in with these ideas, and John, you know, we would sit and fine-tune the ideas together, and then all of a sudden, you know, when you hear these ideas and what they do to the story and add to the story, and it's stunning. It really was stunning to see it put together.
Is that kind of the same for other projects you've done? Just in terms of fun, the fun aspect.
Yeah, the fun. You know what? The fun aspect of it is that we're making records for a living.
Yeah.
We're really blessed that we make records for a living. And that's the fun aspect. Is that, you know, for me, I try to carry the fun aspect from all to all projects. It was really great when John had for the last album that I had worked on with Dream Theater, somebody had asked what it's like working with me on the record. And, you know, one of the highest compliments, as John was saying, you know, that I know my stuff from a technical point of view, but he was saying how much fun it was. Because I think that having fun in the studio, I think it affects the creativity, you know, where it's just like, you know, don't worry, let's just record. Let's not worry. Because if you worry, you have a finite amount of energy. And the more that you dedicate to negative things, less positive energy you have left to create, whether it's playing a better guitar solo or doing something, or, you know, maybe taking some idea that you have out of the box, and you're in a situation where you feel comfortable and you're in a position where you feel like a trusting atmosphere that, you know, that you say, you know what, I want to try this. And even if it doesn't work, well, let's just try it because it might work, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that it's little tiny baby steps. I think when you put all of that stuff together, you can end up with something really great. You know, and I think these guys, they do that. They understand that. They get it. You know, and I try to carry that to all the projects I work on.
So it's positive vibes the whole way.
It really is, you know, like I don't come in with the Tony Robbins flash pots, but I'm thinking about that for the next record.
Yeah, you got to keep everybody smiling. If
yeah.
not,
yeah,
I mean, it doesn't get better usually.
Usually is, you know. There's really no reason. I mean, you know, we had our days where there's stuff that's difficult, and it's like anything else. You have a day where you go, you know, this isn't right. You come back the next day and you go, oh, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And you go, well, you know, maybe it's because we worked 17 hours yesterday, and you come in the next day and there's the realization of what it was, and that's like anything else.
Yeah.
You know, but you just want to try and do something really great, and you know, and I think that they've made history with this, and it's you know, their fans are really intelligent. The fans are intelligent. I think they're going to realize that it's not exactly the same thing that they do every time. It's a lot of elements. You know, it's Dream Theater, but you know what? They're doing something that's big, something that's different, and it's a really big story. I think fans are going to appreciate that. Even if somebody goes, yeah, but you know, I really want them to be just like a basic metal band, but there's metal on there.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
metal on there. There's Dream Theater on there. There's the killer guitar solos, the killer key solos. You know, LaBrie is off the charts with what he's singing. You know, everyone's doing their thing. But at the same time, there's also spots where they're playing for the song. You know, there's one piece where the band is just going nuts. And then they break into this. It's at the end of A New Beginning, Act 1, Song 15. And all of a sudden, at the very tail end of it, Mangini's doing Four on the Floor while John is doing all of these guitar solos. And it sounds like an old Pink Floyd song. Right, and it just goes four and four, like it's going to drive every drummer nuts, because that's really all he does. A couple cymbal crashes, no fills, just really lays down a groove for the rest, so that the rest of the band can do their thing.
Yeah.
Killer, absolutely killer, to respect each other that much that they listen to each other and do the what's right for the song.
The one thing we didn't talk about, we're recording vocals.
Yep,
and you mentioned that you tried, when I saw you at NAMM, you mentioned about you tried some different mics.
We did. We tried a few different mics. You know, LaBrie has a Blueberry mic that he uses quite a bit. I also used some friends of mine over at a company called Mojave. Mojave is the condenser subsidiary of Royer, and I've had a long relationship with Royer. So they had sent me the MA-301s that I used on guitar, and I also used on the snare drum, plus grand piano, SF24V, and 121s on B3. But on vocals, they sent me this new prototype, which is just out now, called an MA-1000. It's kind of, it's a vintage style mic. It's not an old microphone, brand new, but it's got a sort of a, if I were to say what it was close to, the high end has got that really silky feel that a 251 has.
Yeah.
It's got that vibe to it. And we use that on a few tracks, because the prototype I can't even think of what it would be like to develop a microphone from nothing, but you know, there's a lot of steps involved. And once we had it, we did a lot of vocal work. I used a Manly Force preamp. Ivana Manley's a friend of mine, and she'd, you know, I was talking to her about preamps, and I said, you know, this guy sings, his dynamic range is so nuts that it's a bit tough getting a grip on his vocals, that, you know, we don't want to overload anything, get a perfect take, and then it's distorted.
Yeah.
And she was telling me about this new preamp they have coming out. She says, you won't be able to distort it. You know, we put everything together, and our first mission was to sit down and say, you know what? Hey, James, blow up the mic. Blow up everything, see if you can. And you know, he did his best, but he didn't.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had some really great tools that could hold down the... you know, capture him correctly, and they sounded really great.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I think that's just seeing what some of the preliminary reviews are, that his vocal work on this record is really groundbreaking. You know, he's really stretching himself. And again, for a vocalist that's been singing as long as he's been singing, you know, I can't speak highly enough to somebody that says, hey, you know what, we need you to alter your vocal character a bit for this.
Right.
You know?
And not easy.
It's not easy, you know. That's what I call hand me that piano. Really easy to say, a lot harder to do.
Yeah, no kidding.
You
no
know?
Kidding. Last question. This album seems like it's bucking the trend of the music business, where it's larger than life, it's bigger, it's epic, which is as far away from the music business as you can get right now. How do you think it's going to fit in?
You know, it means a lot that that you would bring this up, because that's exactly what it is. That's exactly what this record is that this is kind of the idea. This record is the idea that we want to do a great record, all of us. We just want to do a great record. The fact that the trend, if that's a bad thing, if somebody says, hey, you're bucking the trend because you want to do something that's really great. You know, you have to do something that's cheap and fast. Well, you know, there's that rule of, do you want it good, cheap, and fast? You pick two,
right?
Because you can't have all three, right? And the fact that they want to do something really great, and they wanted to do it irrespective of what the industry says that they should be doing, and they're bucking trends, and I think that they're going to earn a lot of additional respect and a lot of new fans as a result of what they're doing. And I mean, at the end of the day, you got to do what's good for yourself in the business. You got to do, you know what? We want to do this.
Yeah.
Why? Well, because we want to.
Yeah.
You know,
an artist, you need that freedom.
It's an artist, you know, and even from what we do as engineers is that we want to do. You know, I mean, I don't want to set up. Okay, here's your FET 47 that's set up. All right, here's your preamp. Okay, that's done. We're gonna do the same thing again tomorrow. To have to say, you know what? I want to be stretched. I want to be pushed and do big things. You know, and it's such an exciting time to be able to do that. That, you know, I hope that they're the first. I hope that this is the first thing that comes out like this, and then other people are gonna go, you know what? Let's do that. Let's push harder because, you know, as far as budgeting and stuff goes, you know, this is something where none of it was easy. You know, for me to say, was this an easy record to do? This was probably the most challenging record I've done in my career.
Wow.
But was it the most fun? Yes. Was it the most creative? Yes. You know, there's so much satisfaction with doing this. And, you know, they're going and they're going to do tours of all soft cedars, really upscale places, and they're really making this an event. They're making it a special creative event because they're artists, you know, and it's a really, really big step.
Well, let's hope there's more of this in the industry, because we certainly need it. And congratulations on doing it. Congratulations on everything that's been happening for you, and thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. To find out more about Rich, go to richardchickie.com. That's Richard Chickie, CHYCHI.com. And also look out for that new Dream Theater album, which looks like it's going to be really fantastic. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, you can go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. See you next time.